Nick?
This is a question probably for Lyra and Ben, although I'd be eager to hear anyone's comments on it. It seems to be an implication of the knowledge of languages in the plural here, two or more, that the more languages one knows, the more creative one will be. Is that your sense?
There has been some work on bilingualism and creativity. The studies that have been published suggest that kids that are bilingual do succeed on creativity, on standardized creativity tasks more than kids that are monolingual. The same is true for people who've just traveled or lived in other countries. So if you've lived in another country, you'll perform better on tests of creativity than others. It's very hard in principle to compare bilingual data to monolingual data because the ways by which you become bilingual are so diverse and there's so many confounds. So it's often very difficult to know whether you should attribute any effect to bilingualism per se, or is it that smarter people are more able to learn more languages and that's why they're also performing better on this task. So there are lots of interesting questions of interpretation in that literature, but there definitely has been work like that. There are also suggestions that people don't fall prey to some cognitive biases when they're tested in a second language. So as was mentioned earlier, we're often operating on automatic. And so when you're speaking a language that you're very comfortable in, your native language, you often don't examine the assumptions that are hidden in problems or in situations that may require you to look a little more deeply. And when you're taken out of that context, whether in another language or in another culture, you actually examine the assumptions more deeply and so make fewer reasoning errors.
I have a question. I don't know whether it's for Lyra or Gert, but about natural language processing. And I don't know if you're doing any work in that, Gert, but because of the complexities of English and nuances and things, is it not more difficult to have natural language processing on a computer in English than it is in maybe one of the Romance languages that's more organized?
That's maybe for me, right?
Push.
Okay. I think my work is most closely related to natural language processing. Languages differ in terms of the number of words they have. Languages that are used by more people in more different ways in more different situations tend to have larger vocabularies, and English is one such language. It's not the only language that has a huge vocabulary, though. English also is spoken by a diversity of people with not only English but other languages as their native languages, and that produces a diversity of syntaxes or grammars that it gets produced with. And so it's certainly the case that if you were to focus in, developing NLP tools on a particularly restricted set of individuals with a relatively homogeneous set of language behaviors, you'd have an easier task. On the other hand, the tools that people use for natural language processing now take into account the statistical distributions that are observed in the language that they're trying to model. They use relatively powerful tools to code not just what words are used and how frequently, but how frequently these pairs of words and triads of words and quartets of words co-occur. It's not as though it's an insurmountable enterprise.
I just want to add something. Languages are so complex that we don't actually know how to measure how complex they are. And so we can't, in principle, compare languages. So we couldn't, in principle, say this language is more complex than this other language. So you can say this language has more vocabulary items than this other language. In some cases, even that is very problematic because some languages are agglutinative, and so you can make infinite numbers of words. Whatever word is also a very unprincipled unit. Some languages may have a relatively simple phonological inventory, but a bare of a morphological system. So English is morphologically very, very simple compared to lots and lots of languages in the world. So I don't know that we actually know enough about languages to be able to predict in what language NLP would be easiest, just because language is different in so many different respects and can have complexity in so many different systems.
I just wanted to add here that it's like quite amazing how much computer technology has evolved over the years, and you probably all noticed that Google Translate does an excellent job at translating from language X to language Y, whichever pair of languages it is. So things have gone quite far. And I just want to add here that, much of the computer science technology behind Google Translate is also predicated on advances in, I wouldn't say neuroscience, but at least neural modeling, I guess artificial neural networks, because some of the machine learning communities, right? And so this, I guess, also underscores the point that, learning about the brain is a very interdisciplinary approach, and, that language is definitely integral also to how, the study of the brain. I guess that's also, I guess, clear from all the contributions here.
Thank you. Shlomo?
Yeah, I have a question about what kind of relates to maybe to complexity, but in the sense of is there some notion of creativity versus, well, the language, the ambiguity in the language? Because it seems that, well, the more ambiguous something is, in some sense, it gives you more potential for creativity. And this is sort of a paradox I find a lot in, and, you know, people sometimes parallel music to language and stuff like that. But in some sense, the idea that you're in some way ambiguous and you're not actually parsing it in one way opens more creative opportunities. It's kind of a fine balance between, you know, losing communication with the other side, but also in some sense it kind of opens up this. So is there any evidence about, you know, differences in creativity based on the some inherent ambiguity that might exist in the language?
It's very, very hard. I've been thinking about how to measure ambiguity or vagueness in a language. Ambiguity and vagueness are different things. I'm not going to go into how they're different, but it's very, very hard to have a principled measure of ambiguity in a language. I do want to point out that all languages have a whole lot of ambiguity, and all languages allow infinite capacity for creativity. So all human languages allow words to be recombined in an infinite set of new ways. So you can create sentences that you have never heard before and likely no one has ever uttered before with ease, because you have a large set of components that can be recombined in all these new ways. But even starting with how to measure relative ambiguity in a language, there are all kinds of technical reasons why that's hard to do in a principled way. I'm very interested in this question, but let me tell you, it's not easy.
Yeah. I want to draw, one of the things that struck me about this panel, this is common to all four of you, was the centrality, even if it's indirect, of visuality in your presentations. You had us close your eyes. You're in a lab of visuality. You invoked a 17th century Ben statement, and David's talk about semiosis and representation. Visuality is central to this. I just want to ask this with a somewhat flippant question, but what would happen if you import Pale-Sert's description into your, I don't know if it's possible, Gert, into your brain, and what would you come out with? I mean, because it's a description. What I'm getting at is the importance of visuality on the one hand, but visuality depends upon some kind of built-up knowledge system or some kind of knowledge system that we have simultaneously. Again, I don't know what a civet cat looked like, and I looked it up, and I still don't imagine, but I know what a wallaby looks like. So I'm just wondering what would happen if you stick it into this reverse-engineered cognitive processing tool. If it comes out, it could very well come out more coherent than my brain.
What will probably come out is spike trains, and they look like spike trains. I'm not sure what you can make out of it, but yeah, the brain is quite amazing at how things are represented, but representation is key, and abstracting features is key in what was happening there, but I wouldn't visualize it. But
okay. Anybody else have any questions? Yes.
I really like Shlomo's question, and I wanted to follow up on that. I know very little about this area. So if you were to look at poetry in a given language, and do natural language processing, because that tends to be more abstract or kind of like what Shlomo was hinting at, or even satire and humor. Now, how well they are expressed in one language as opposed to the other. Do you think that would give you a metric of how expressive or complex language A is as opposed to language B? Can you come up with some objective metric?
No.
No. Next question. I agree.
What I really wanted to say is, people do this, right? They try to feed poetry into NLP systems, and it fails massively because NLP is predicated on assumptions about grammatical structure that largely don't hold in most of the creative forms that we're most interested in because they are the most creative, most ambiguous. What's that? Oh yeah. That's a property of the NLP. I agree fully. So if the question is a hypothetical one about an NLP system that had all of the properties of a human processor, then maybe it would do better with poetry. But I still don't think that you'd have then any metric for the complexity of that language. One way to think about it is people who do computational linguistics, who do natural language processing, point out that at any point in a sentence, you have far more possible interpretations of what the structure is and what the senses of each of the particular words used is meant to be than we are aware of, because we actually pare down the possible interpretations. We ignore most anything that's probably not relevant in the given context. But if you're just a dumb processor, every sentence is massively ambiguous. And so to find the cases that we recognize as being ambiguous are just the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that are so ambiguous that we can't even resolve them, or we notice that there's a possibility to resolve them in some other way. But there's so much ambiguity in language that looking at those outlying cases, I don't think would tell you much about the language as a whole. It's my intuition.
Though looking at metaphor and other non-literal language certainly is a very useful tool for studying how humans create more and more complex knowledge and how we come to be so smart and have so many sophisticated ideas that go far beyond the physical. Ben and I both do a lot of work on metaphor, and metaphor is one of these creative tools in our language where we get to use words that we're familiar with in slightly novel contexts. And when you make an extension that's sufficiently novel and one that is also interpretable to other people and useful to them, that becomes a conventional metaphor that people like to spread around and use. And I tend to think of the dictionary as being like a retirement home for metaphors, where something gets sufficiently frequently used, it can go and become a meaning of a word. That's how words get into those meanings get into the dictionary. But so thinking about humor, metaphor, lots of other tropes, non-literal language is a very useful tool for understanding how we build knowledge and how we are creative.
David, last word.
Oh, I was just going to make an observation that I said it in my talk subtly, but I gather you have laboratories for the study of language, so you can create relatively closed experimental situations. In my own background and in the study of language in anthropology, we would accept that that's extremely difficult. And the part that maybe would be more present in an open kind of live situation is the actual historical content would be quite specific to the time. And it would make it a little less easy to make positive claims about the language as if it has always been so and always will be so. So I just wanted to sort of throw that out there, just because I come from a different side of studying language, and it's a much more lived, dynamic process.
Well, I think what this shows is that we know a lot more than we did. We have a lot more that we need to know. And if I could, Bill Mobley's not here, but I was thinking that this is why I think being an historian, the past is so interesting, because it's There's a lot of uncertainty there. There's a lot we don't know. But as the more you engage in human action and we try and understand more, and we do, more questions come out. So I'd like to thank the panelists, thank Sandy and Pitt.